Welcome to Leonard Lopate Weekend, where we bring you three of our favorite segments from the last week in case you missed them. You can find all of our segments on the WNYC app, our website at WNYC.org, or on iTunes. Just search for Leonard Lopate. And of course, you can also listen to us live on the radio every weekday starting at noon.
Listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Barney Frank became the first openly gay member of Congress in the 1980s. He'd been living with his secret for more than 36 years, ever since he was 14. He'd realized as a teen that he wanted to play a role in government, but since he was gay, that might doom a future career. Still, he became one of the most influential legislators of his time, and during his time in Congress, he witnessed two seismic shifts, a sharp drop in prejudice against LGBT people and an equally sharp increase in anti-government opinion. In a memoir he's called Frank, he chronicles the shifts. It's published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. I'm very pleased it has brought Barney Frank back to our show today. Hello.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
You write that in 1954, at the age of 14, you already knew you were attracted to males. Weren't homosexuals often bullied in school in those days? Were you?
No, for two reasons. First of all, I hadn't told anybody I was homosexual, as we then called it. Secondly,
We didn't use the word gay in those
no.
days. There was another word that I'm not going to use on the air.
Right. There were several others. But I didn't conform to the physical stereotype. Actually, that gave me sort of some protection against some of the prejudice for a long time. So, people didn't know it, and I wasn't bullied for that reason.
And did you know any other teens in Bayonne who were gay?
No. Well, there was a young man in our high school who had the kind of obvious external characteristics of the stereotype, and he was bullied and taunted. But I never interacted with him and never talked to anybody else who I knew was gay.
And that must have been a warning to you as well.
Yeah.
Didn't you first become interested in working in government while you were watching the Army-McCarthy hearings?
That was one of the two things. In 1954, I have an older sister, Ann Lewis, who'd actually was very close to Hillary Clinton and who worked in the Clinton administration as press secretary. And she was precocious and worked in politics. But we had a television set. My father was what we now call an early adopter. He bought a television set in 1940, well before there were many programs. And so there were two events in 1954 that made me think there's something I want to do. One was the Army McCarthy hearings, watching This and that fascinated me. It was a case of people standing up to this terrible bully, this man who had used anti-communism to wreck people's lives, and he was finally, people were standing up to him. And the forum in which they did it was talking and arguing. And I knew by then that I was good at talking and arguing. So it wasn't just that this interested me as something that I would like to do. It played to my strength. Additionally, there was the murder of Emmett Till. He was my age, an African-American teenager from Chicago, who was brutally murdered in Mississippi, where he was visiting because he looked the wrong way at a white woman. And I was outraged that law enforcement people were in on the murder and the federal government wasn't doing anything. So together, that gave me the sense that there were things I wanted to see done and that I probably had some of the skills that could help do it.
What were your parents' takes on those things?
My parents were very liberal. Great. As I said, we were pretty secular. The closest thing we had to a Bible was the old New York Post, back when the Post was still what I thought was a reasonable newspaper.
Dorothy Schiff's newspaper.
Yeah, it was very good. James Wexler was the editor and some great reporters. And they shared my views on both. I mean, they shared the horror of McCarthy and they shared the outrage on the racial issue.
Joseph Welsh, in the hearings you write, used the term pixie, which was meant to evoke anti-gay prejudice to demean Roy Cohn, who was gay, and he was McCarthy's chief aide. And it went wholly unrebuked, even by liberals. And you admit that you were one of the non-rebukers.
Right, but it was actually more than pixie. He said fairy. What happened was he was cross-examining, and he became a great liberal hero, and he was cross-examining Roy Cohn, and who was a gay man and a terrible hypocrite and a extreme right-winger, and he died of AIDS protesting to the very last that he wasn't gay. It was just a bizarre performance, and the media let him get away with it far too long. But he's chronicled for people who are interested in, what is it, Angels in America. But he said something to Welsh. Welsh asked him how a certain document had gotten out. He had obviously leaked it. Cohn did. And Welsh said, well, Mr. Cohn, did it come from a pixie? And at that point, McCarthy interjected to defend Cohn and said, well, will you tell me what is a pixie? And at that point, Welsh seized the opportunity as a good trial lawyer and said, a pixie, Senator, is a close relation of a fairy. So, yeah, and that was it. Everybody knew he meant Roy Cohn. And I was one of those who said, good, he got the bastard.
And that's been a problem for homosexuals for a long time, that on the one hand, they want people exposed as gay, even though that would suggest that there was something wrong with what they were doing.
Well, I take some credit for coming up with what seems to me a useful rule. Now I think it's much less of an issue because the negative consequences have severely gone away. But I sort of adopted my own behavior's rule. I first got elected to office in 1972. The state legislature. And that year I filed gay rights bills. Now, I was closeted, and I really had this decision. I was not going to be open and honest about who I was, but I was determined not to in any way give in to any gay prejudice, and that I was going to fight against the prejudice. And I found it particularly despicable, and still do, that there were gay men who, mostly gay men, there were only a couple of lesbians. The Republicans among us tend to be the men. And they practice a gay life, they engage in various activities, socialize with other gay people, but then support policies that penalize gay people. And my rule is that there's a right to privacy but not a right to hypocrisy. And I think the answer is if people are being hypocritical and persecuting other gay people, then they've forfeited their right to privacy.
I don't know if you were in Congress at the time when Representative Bauman of Maryland was found soliciting gay sex, and he was one of the people who was pushing the Hyde Amendment.
Yeah, no, in fact, I mentioned him somewhere in my book. He and I didn't overlap. He was defeated the year I was elected, but he became very angry or sort of jealous of me. As you say, he was an extreme right-winger, one of their leaders, and supported the Hyde Amendment, which was anti-abortion, but also supported anti-gay legislation. And then he was arrested because he was having sex with underage teenage males, and was defeated. And later, he was so angry, he wrote a book, and he kind of outed me in the book, not entirely. And he was kind of unhappy that I was able to be, at that point, somewhat open about being gay privately, but not publicly.
Do you know if there are any closeted people in Congress today?
Oh, yeah, I'm sure there were a couple.
Didn't President Eisenhower issue an executive order that decreed that homosexuals could never get security clearances?
Absolutely.
What was the rationale for that?
That we were bad people. Some people say, oh, it was because of the fear of blackmail. But if you're saying that people who are gay can't get security clearance because of blackmail, then the answer would be, well, but I'm out, so I can't be blackmailed. You can't blackmail someone about something he's made public. But that would not have saved it. In fact, Eisenhower did that. The McCarthy era was not just anti-communist. They were anti-homosexual as well, which is another reason why I found Cohn so despicably hypocritical. And there was a report from a Senate committee at the end of 1950, the employment of homosexuals and other perverts in the federal government. And it said in the report that you can't have a homosexual there. He's a rotten apple. He'll ruin the whole barrel. So the Eisenhower executive order was a flat-out ban on anybody who was homosexual getting security clearance, which meant not only you couldn't work in the federal government, you couldn't work for a contractor who was working for the Defense Department. It affected millions of people. And it, frankly, was continued by Kennedy, Johnson, and Carter, and it wasn't until Bill Clinton that we got rid of it.
Some of the early language used to describe homosexuals in immigration bills was afflicted with a psychopathic personality and aliens afflicted with sexual deviation. And that, how long did that last?
Well, the first one, psychopathic personality as a kind of euphemism for keeping us out. And by the way, people should understand, this was in the immigration law, and it said if you were in that category, by which they meant homosexuals, they didn't want to use any nasty words back then, you couldn't even come as a tourist. This was a total ban. Now, it was inconsistently applied, but it was applied in some cases, and it was adopted around the turn of the 20th century. And what happened was, That it said psychopathic language until about the 1960, as I chronicle in the book. And a man who was gay, who was a non-citizen resident, left, and he was told he couldn't come back. And he basically said, look, I like to have sex with guys, but I'm not a psychopath. And the administrations and the Congress were afraid that this liberal Supreme Court, run by Earl Warren and William Brennan, that they would agree that you weren't a psychopath just because you were homosexual. So that's when the sexual deviancy language was added, and it was added during a process which involved John Kennedy, and then after he was murdered, Lyndon Johnson, and a very liberal Congress in 1965. They toughened the anti-gay provision.
So liberals have changed on this position. Why do you think we have seen this? These two things, the seismic shifts in American public opinion, the sharp drop in prejudice against LGBT people, and the equally sharp increase in anti-government sentiments?
Well, obviously the two, they're not related to each other. On the question of the diminution of homophobia, I think it's a case of essentially reality defeating prejudice. It begins in 1969, and there was a clearer beginning to the movement for LGBT equality from Stonewall, not far from where we now are, in that sharp line of 1969. But that didn't come out of the blue. Starting with the end of World War II, America began to get more serious about human rights. I think the terrible negative example of Hitler and what this led to with the genocide against Jews and some other groups,
including homosexuals who were sent to concentration
very
camps.
Much. And disabled people. So it began for the first time after World War II with a serious attempt to get rid of racism as an official doctrine. And then the women's movement became active. And the philosophies of those movements, individuals should not be victimized by prejudice, they should be judged on their own merits, it kind of spread to us. So that's what got into it. But the second part was this. More and more of us began to be honest about who we were. And that's what broke the back. There was such a great disparity between this prejudice and what it said about us and who we were that as more and more people came out, the prejudice was beaten.
And you broke your silence in the 1980s. When you had to run your first reelection campaign after coming out, what were some of the obstacles you faced?
Well, there weren't many. I was very pleasantly surprised. A woman ran against me, who had been a member of the Moral Majority. People will hark back to that sort of right-wing so-called Christian group, although many Christians were.
Was that Jerry Falwell?
Yeah, it was his group. Many Christians obviously were as appalled by it as I was. And she was running, figuring that because I was out, that she'd benefit. And as the campaign went on, it was clear that it was having almost no negative effect. In the end, I think it probably cost me maybe 2%. The answer I've said to people is this. By that time, I was one of the most prominent legislative advocates of gay rights. From the day I joined the Massachusetts legislature in 72 and filed the first gay rights bills in our history, throughout that period. So if you really, really were turned off by the whole notion of treating gay people fairly, you weren't going to vote for me anyway. So she got so frustrated that finally she decided she had to use the issue. So she began using the issue by announcing that she wasn't going to use the issue. And pretty soon that just turned on her, and she wound up humiliating herself.
Do you think that some of your concerns about civil liberties and civil rights come from the fact that you faced bigotry, anti-Semitism as a Jew?
Probably. I don't remember that constantly. It is certainly the case that Jews in America have generally been more opposed to discrimination against others. I do think the experience of being yourself discriminated against is important. And even you see this with regard to African Americans. There have been some issues between the African-American community in general and gay rights, and some of the ministers have been a problem. But the large ethnic group that is most supportive of gay rights in the Congress has been the Congressional Black Caucus. They've been very good. In my own case, yeah, I've always felt strongly against discrimination. I think my own status was there. When the Republicans finally won control of the House in 1995, after the Democrats had been in control for 40 years, some of my colleagues were dispirited. They'd never really been in the minority before. And I was there asked by the Democratic leadership to help read the resistance, the opposition. And someone said, well, you don't seem to be quite as, taken aback by this. And I said, well, a lot of my colleagues have never been in the minority. I'm a gay left-handed Jew. minority status is not all that new to me.
My guest is Barney Frank, who represented the 4th Congressional District of Massachusetts for nearly five decades, chaired the House Financial Services Committee from 2007 to 2013. He's the first member of Congress to enter a same-sex marriage while serving in office, and these days he's a regular commentator on MSNBC. He has written a book called Frank, which is published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. And we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Barney Frank, who's written a memoir called Frank, obviously having a number of different meanings. The book is published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. You felt that it was really important to be as frank as possible in this book?
I did, but the title was their choice. I was glad to write the book, but on marketing, I deferred to them. They're the marketing experts. There was one issue. If there were a Massachusetts publisher, today is the official publication date, and I'm running around town, a Massachusetts publisher probably would have noticed that today is St. Patrick's Day and might have realized that Fifth Avenue would be somewhat inaccessible, but we're coping.
You began your career in government at 16 when you volunteered to work for Adlai Stevenson's second presidential
yes.
campaign. You say it wasn't fun.
No, and that's one of the points I want to make to people. Many of the things you do in a presidential campaign or a campaign for any office can be tedious. What makes them important is that is the cause in which on whose behalf you're doing it. But stuffing envelopes is not any more interesting if you're doing it for a guy running for president than if you're doing it for a shoe store. Or, you know, making calls to people to ask for money, or going door-to-door to ask them to vote. And I say that because I don't want people to come to political campaigning with false expectations and then fall away. It's important to know that what's valuable about campaigning is the cause on whose behalf you're doing it. Inherently, it's not fun.
A lot of people have complained that pretty much after you're elected, the rest of your a lot of your time is spent trying to get money for the next campaign.
I was spared that. That's become increasingly the case, particularly with these outrageous decisions from this right-wing Supreme Court telling us that money is speech. But for many, many members of Congress, well, that's true of senators. You know, virtually every senator's got to be careful. But a very large number of the House, well over half, really are not in any serious danger of losing. So I had to raise money in 80 and 82. Between that and 2008, when there was turmoil because of the financial crisis, I never had to do any serious fundraising.
How did the Democrats come to lose the white working class vote?
It's the central question.
When does that go back to?
I believe it goes back to the transformation in the global and world and American economy up through the 70s because of America's position in the world. If you had a high school degree, even if you didn't, if you were a white guy, because there was prejudice, African-Americans and women, you could go to work at a factory and make a good living. You could get a job in the building trades and make a good living. And then the world shifted because of our trade practices so that, and this is why we have the inequality we have, people with high-end talents, technological sophistication, advanced degrees began to do better, but the auto plants diminished and the steel plants left. And so what we have is the average white working guy is much worse off than before. Now, here's the paradox. There are some people who are anti-government because they hate the government philosophically, particularly wealthy people who think, hey, that government's going to come after me. Our frustration are people who really would benefit from much of what we want to do, but they vote for people who are union busters, et cetera. And I think the problem is this. These are people who believe that government should play a positive role, but are very angry that the government has not protected them economically, and they express that by then voting for people who are anti-government, and the problem gets worse.
Thomas Frank wrote a book about this, but he also pointed out that there were other issues,
yes,
cultural
issues.
Yes,
I think he was wrong. For example, guns is a problem for us, but I don't think either religion or gay rights is the issue.
What about abortion?
I don't think, no. Abortion has become important to right-wingers, but I will tell you that I work with my Democratic colleagues. None of them think they're going to lose votes because of abortion. Abortion is something people feel passionately about. It's a difficult issue in some ways, but of that trilogy, Gods, Guns, and Gays, guns are the only ones where we tend to lose votes. There's been some anti-abortion feeling, but I will tell you this, that members of Congress do not feel pressure to vote to outlaw abortion. They do feel pressure not to vote to ban guns. I did not fully understand this, but I think it's now clear that, as far as gay rights is concerned, that's now become an issue that the Republicans fear that we use against them. They want to take it off the table. I believe it is fundamentally the economic reality that white, working, middle-class people have been damaged by economic trends, and they resent a government that hasn't tried to help them as they see it, especially because to many of them, they exaggerate this, the government's been there for black people, it's been there for gay people, it's been there for women, and they're the only group it hasn't helped.
But isn't there also some kind of a gap between the way things work on a national level and on the state level? In the last election, despite an awful lot of this sentiment, Barack Obama won re-election, won it pretty handily, and yet Congress has gone totally to people vowed to destroy Obama.
Two things. Yeah, but Barack Obama did not get the kind of vote from white men that traditionally Democrats have gotten. In fact, the only groups of white men who regularly vote Democratic now in the majority are gay and Jewish. So Obama lost.
In your case, both.
Yes, but I still only get to vote once. Obama lost white men. He won because he got such overwhelming majorities against African Americans, Hispanics, not against, from women, etc. Here's the problem. The groups that most vote Democratic for a variety of reasons are the least likely to turn out in lower visibility elections. So what crucified the Democrats in 2014 was not so much people who voted for Obama who then switched to Republican. There were some of those. It was people who voted for Obama and stayed home and didn't vote.
And why do you think that is? After all, some of the people who have been elected, you would think would be totally antithetical to anyone who would have voted for Obama.
What troubles me is that there is a form of voter suppression from my friends on the left. First of all, it's just a norm. If your socioeconomic status is lower, if you're busy trying to keep body and soul together, civic duty doesn't appear as high to you as trying to keep food on the table. And so a high visibility election like the presidency, people pay more attention. But beyond that, I have some criticism of my friends on the left. There are two forms of voter suppression going on in America today. One is the outrageous legal requirements by Republicans that you have all sorts of documents that many people don't have, elderly people born in the South. So the Republicans have been engaged in actual voter suppression, and then this right-wing Supreme Court majority aids them by throwing out the Voting Rights Act. But we have voter suppression from the left. It's intellectual. We have people who say, you know what, the politicians don't care about you. They only listen to big money. They're all the same. They're all corrupt. You have media outlets that do a very good job of pointing out what government does badly, but never talk about anything the government does well. So if you watch them regularly, you would wonder why you should vote. And I think that's part of the problem. I want people on the left to say, you know what, things are terrible, and therefore we should get out and vote and change them. And I would make this distinction. I was debating this subject with someone from the Occupy movement, and I said, you know, I wish you were more like the Tea Party in adopting political tactics. And I was disappointed that I never saw a voting rights table, a voting registration table at an Occupy site. And her answer was, well, that's not what we're into. Well, that's too bad, because that's how you win.
My guest is Barney Frank, who has written a memoir called Frank. It's published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. It's one thing to enter politics with a certain amount of ideals. What happens when you finally are there and you have to deal with the nuts and bolts of it?
Oh, I would hope you would recognize that the best ideals in the world, the most passionately felt wonderful ideals, do you no good if you aren't effective in implementing them. So I think the moral imperative is the more you care for your ideals, the more you should try to get them implemented. And that means you understand where the levers of power are and how to operate, and you work very hard to advance what you care about, understanding that you sometimes often aren't going to get everything, and you try and do the best you can, and then you start working the next day for more.
Getting back to the anti-government feelings on the left. Are you talking about John Stewart? Some people feel that he makes people feel smug about how ineffective government is, and that doesn't inspire.
No, I think that's true. He's very funny, and much of what he says is accurate. But if that's all you talk about, there's a problem. And people say, well, you know, he's not the news guy. No, he's not. But there are an awful lot of people who only watch that show or watch it for their major source of news. Yeah, I do think an exclusive discussion of negatives has an overall negative effect and is depressing turnout. Why, if nobody ever does anything good, why would you vote?
In 1966, you were appointed director of student affairs at the Institute of Politics at the John F. Kennedy School, and you write that in a decision that I count in hindsight among the stupidest in which I ever participated, we invited Defense Secretary Robert McNamara to Cambridge. Wasn't it well known by then that the war effort was something of a disaster? Were you trying to confront him, or?
Oh no, no. We invited a range of people. So being invited didn't mean we agreed with his views. We had people from the left to the right, and the job of the university was to invite. The mistake was, this was early on. We had not yet had the kind of disruptive behavior from students, and here's the problem: it was a good idea to have him there. The format, however, was outdated. We thought it was important to have a situation where students could talk to some of these political leaders in informal closed sessions. And that was a good idea for many, so they would just talk about what it was really like. But we should have realized that people felt too strongly about the Vietnam War to accept any kind of privacy about the discussion.
There's a whole chapter devoted to your defense of Clinton, called Defending Clinton, and you write that ever since 1993, you've been defending both Clintons. Didn't you get a chance serving on the Financial Services Committee to witness firsthand the investigation into Whitewater, which is being brought up again recently?
Yeah, I'm appalled with that with regard to it. People said, well, there were these questions. I served on first the Banking Committee, it was then called. It became Financial Services. You're right about that. When they were investigating Whitewater, and then I was on the Judiciary Committee. And one of the best questions I ever got to ask a witness was when Kenneth Starr, the impeacher-in-chief, came. Before the congressional elections of 98, he sent Congress a recommendation that Bill Clinton be impeached and thrown out of office because of Monica Lewinsky. He had also been, for even longer than the Lewinsky investigation, been investigating Whitewater, the FBI files, so-called scandal, the travel office problem, even the murder of Vince Foster. After the election, he gave us a report that said, oh, by the way, on all those other things I've been investigating, there was no problem. Nobody did anything wrong. So the fact is, with the exception, a big one, of Bill Clinton's oral sex with Monica Lewinsky, the harshest negative investigator vindicated the Clintons against all these charges. People forget that.
They're going after her again. You push for funding for AIDS research. How do you feel about the use of Truvada as a form of pre-exposure prophylaxis to prevent new HIV infections?
I think that's a choice people should be able to make. I am very opposed to the notion that you withhold from individuals things that they might use responsibly because other people might abuse them. I think that's a terrible mistake we make as a society, and I think that's the people argue, well, some people will know that this is available and behave irresponsibly. That is no reason to withhold it from people who will be responsible.
Although people feel stigmatized when they take it.
Well, then they don't have to take it. I don't know anybody who's said we're going to tie you down and make you take it. If you feel stigmatized, don't take it. Take it privately. And by the way, there are some people who don't feel stigmatized. I think, frankly, that less and less should we feel stigmatized.
We have very little time left, but I want to deal a little bit with the financial crisis. What was it like to be a legislator during that time? What did you think about some of the too big to fail decisions and what those banks are going through now?
What I felt was that we had no option given the existing law but to do what we did, but that it was important to make sure we would have options in the future, and I believe the bill does that. The Bush administration faced some decisions, and by the way, one of the examples of Democrats getting blamed for things, every bailout that happened was initiated by George Bush. But, of course, you have people who say, oh, the Democrats did all the bailouts. I think we provided, for example, we made some changes. When AIG couldn't pay its debts, $170 billion. The Fed advanced them some money, and then they got some money from the TARP. The power that the Fed had to advance $85 billion to AIG to pay its debts and keep it in business no longer exists. Our bill abolished it.
And then Hank Greenberg sued because he felt humiliated.
Yes,
but that's I
have to say that people should know that. The founder of AIG sued the federal government after AIG had $170 billion in debt that they didn't know was there, how much, and they had the federal government pay them out. But I have to say, Mr. Greenberg does deserve the description. He is the arsonist who is suing the firefighter for water damage.
Barney, we have very little time. A major piece of legislation that you did in response to this is constantly under attack. Do you think it's going to survive?
It depends on the 2016 election. President Obama signed a bill that made a slight change. He shouldn't have done that. Nancy Pelosi, Elizabeth Warren, and others fought back. So I'm confident now that the Republicans will not be able to weaken that bill in any substantial way, as hard as they are trying, through Obama's term. And it'll be one of the issues in the 2016 election. If the Republicans win the House, Senate, and presidency, yes, we will be back to the Wild West days of unregulated financial activity with very negative consequences. And I hope people will understand that when they vote.
Barney Frank's memoir is called Frank. It is published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. Mr. Frank these days is writing some op-ed columns for a local newspaper, also working on MSNBC, and enjoying retirement with your husband?
Yes, with Jim.
And I thank you so much for being on
our
show. Thank
you. It was a good time to have. It was a good discussion.
You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Kazuo Ishiguro has explored memory in novels that have been set in Japan, Britain, and China. His last novel, Never Let Me Go, published 10 years ago, was set in an alternative Britain of the post-Thatcher years. But his latest novel takes us to a far more remote world, to Britain some 1,500 years ago, not long after King Arthur's death, where an elderly couple and everyone around them struggle with deeply clouded memories. The Buried Giant is published in the United States by Knopf, and I'm very pleased it has brought Kazuo Ishiguro back to our show today. Hello.
Hello. It's very nice to be here again.
Your book is set sometime after the Romans left Britain. Why that time?
Well, part of the attraction is that it's a complete blank. No historian seems to be confident about what happened in that period. I'm talking about the period around between about 410 AD when the Romans leave Britain and the time the Anglo-Saxons arrive, probably around 490.
And they've been called the Lost Centuries.
Yeah, this is Britain before it becomes England. You know, the immigrants landing from Europe, the Anglo-Saxons, you can loosely call them that, become the English and set up the English kind of society there. So we're talking about that strange gap just before Britain becomes England.
Is what we know about this time only things that were written later, like the Arthurian legends?
The Arthurian legends actually have very little historical basis. I mean, they're written a long time later, really to reflect the time when they were written, I think. And I personally don't have that much interest in the Holy Grail and Guinevere and Lancelot, that kind of thing.
You do have Sir Gawain in this novel.
Well, I do have him because if there was any kind of historical basis for King Arthur, a lot of people think it might have been some sort of military leader of the Britons, that's to say the indigenous people, who led a kind of series of resistance wars against the invading and settling Anglo-Saxons. And at some point, once again, this is kind of more rumor than historical fact because no one knows, he actually imposed some sort of enforced peace, almost like a dictator, enforcing peace. And so for a generation or two, these two tribes kind of lived in apparently peaceful coexistence, but that eventually broke down. And people think there was possibly a kind of a wipeout of the indigenous Britons, and it became England. That's one version of it, and that's the one I went with because it served my purposes metaphorically.
Although the reasons for this peace in your novel, not King Arthur, but something different, which we will get to in a moment. There's also the invasion of the Norsemen. So this was a strange time.
Yeah, a lot of people are, landing and invading. But I'm really looking at a, at a situation that probably has many echoes with more recent contemporary historical situation. A lot of minorities in a larger piece of land, they're coexisting. Sometimes they've actually intermingled, intermarried, but there's been some real tension between them in the recent past, and they've had to forget about it in order to coexist. But can that coexistence hold? And to some extent, it depends on people not remembering what happened a generation or two back.
You mentioned metaphor. Your title is a metaphor. But could we also say that this is also a metaphor, or at least something that echoes more recent history, like Rwanda, Bosnia, South Africa?
In fact, precisely, you know, those three situations were what triggered my thinking about this novel in the first place. Because here we have examples, all of those examples you've mentioned. I mean, I think societal memory seems to have played a large part in whether, you know, there was violence or whether there was not violence. Certainly in the case of South Africa, I think that country is to be congratulated. I mean, it's almost miraculous that after apartheid, South Africa avoided civil war. And that's partly because I think the great leaders that they had at the end of apartheid very carefully and deliberately balanced that question: how much do we want to remember about the apartheid years? How much should we forget? And even if it meant grievances and injustice sometimes went unpunished, they recognized that we had to, you know, they had to achieve that balance in order for the sake of stability and not to start a cycle of violence. And so I think that question, when is it better to remember, when is it better to forget, is one that haunts many societies. When you mentioned Rwanda and Bosnia, there are cases where people had managed to forget for a while, and then maybe some force, some political leaders, for their own ends, deliberately reawaken certain memories to mobilize hatred and violence.
After your first three novels, Remains of the Day was the third. You've changed course with each succeeding book. In an interview, you referred to the first three books by saying that you'd written the same book three times and gotten away with it. Do you feel driven to experiment with fictional genres as a result of feeling like you cheated for a while?
I was being maybe a little bit harsh on myself to say, you know, I was repeating myself and getting away with it. I mean, I'm more dignified.
People have always said that writers are writing the same book again and again in some way.
I respect that in a writer. I respect that in filmmakers. I respect that in all kind of art forms. If they're literally repeating themselves, yeah, there's a problem. But, I mean, I think it's the proper thing for a writer to discover a certain kind of area that is of special importance to him or her and keep cultivating it. So I hope I'm not actually literally repeating myself, but you know, each time I move the thing a little bit on, every time I write a book, by the time I finished it, there's a whole new series of questions that have been raised by the writing of that book, and so that primes me up to write the next book. So that's how I go about things.
One departure here is your narrative voice. In the past, it was generally first person, but here we have this omniscient narrator who's addressing a modern British audience, telling the story of 1,500 years ago.
There's quite a lot of third person, but there are bursts of first person as well. But I guess, I mean, I felt it was more appropriate this time to go for a more flexible narrator, because in the past I was concerned with the individual struggle with memory. You know, just one person wondering, how much do I want to remember of my personal past? How much can I bear to look at what I did in the past? This time I'm looking at this question at the level of a whole society. So I felt, you know, I couldn't just have one mind, you know, dominate the whole story. The other important thing this time round for me was that I was asking that same question about, you know, when is it better to remember, when is it better to forget, as applied to a marriage. Now, a marriage that's gone on for a long time. The role of shared memories in a marriage, I think, is fascinating. And that same dilemma that we talked about in relation to societies applies to important long-distance relationships. You know, how much do you want to remember of the dark passages of your marriage?
So this couple, to some degree, has lasted as long as it has because they don't remember the problems of the past. But also we have the Saxons and the Britons going through this collective amnesia, and that is preventing them from warring against each other. But if the mist that has led to it, that's part of the story, is lifted, well, then everybody regains their memories and a lot of problems are going to arise.
Yeah, all hell may break loose. I mean, you don't know. And that applies to the marriage as well, I suppose. I mean, but there are important differences between, I guess, you know, the way an elderly couple who have been married for many years will struggle with that question, the way a society that's so at ease with itself would struggle with that. I mean, I think as a man and woman get closer to the end of their natural lives, I mean, the need to remember even the bad things of their life together, I think, starts to become quite urgent. But otherwise, you know, you ask yourself, well, is our love based on something phony? If it's based on a lot of forgotten things and suppressed memories, is our love real? And so they ask this question, surely, you know, what we feel for each other is strong enough to withstand any memory being resurrected. But as the story goes on, they start to actually worry if that's really true. You know, would our love survive when the mist clears and we start to remember things? Is our love going to be strong enough?
My guest is Kazuo Ishiguro, and his latest novel is The Buried Giant. The couple is named Axel and Beatrice. They're Britons. And I wonder about the names. Beatrice comes from the Latin for voyager or traveler, and Axel is a Scandinavian variation of Absalon, meaning father of peace. Are there a couple of peace traveling?
Well, that's much too clever for me. I mean, I didn't know either of those things. You just told me, actually.
Did you know that Gawain's horse named Horace? Well, we know about Horace. He lived in the time when Rome was a republic, turning into an empire.
Oh yeah, I knew that. You know, that these famous names. But what I did was I had a couple of kind of scholarly lists of names that scholars had compiled. You know, one for the Anglo-Saxons and one for the Britons. And every time I needed a name, I picked a name off that list. You know, I never like to go for great symbolism or resonance in names because I'm not writing that kind of, you know, symbol-based fiction. You know, I want my names to be as arbitrary as they would be in real life, I guess.
But the title is a metaphor, and this is obviously a book of ideas. That's often a problem for a writer. A book of ideas then has to be turned into a work that works on other levels. You can't be didactic.
I'm not sure if I like the idea that it's a book of ideas. I mean, I think all... You know, I think all my novels are based, you know, they have quite strong themes and quite strong questions at the heart of them. But essentially, I write my books to convey the emotions that come out of the ideas and the dilemmas. I'm not concerned. I mean, if I wanted to just express ideas, I'd write nonfiction or an essay. I mean, so this book is about you know, the fact that human beings have to struggle with this question about memory. And when to suppress it and when not to, both at the personal level and at the societal level. And I'm really concerned about the actual emotions that come out of that.
Well, there's also the matter of historic memory. Today, Anglo-Saxon and Briton are used almost interchangeably, but 1,500 years ago, these people were at war with each other.
Yeah, and I suppose the Anglo-Saxons were the immigrants, the invaders. You know, but certainly, I mean, you know, with some justification, I guess, you know, people tend to think of these things as synonymous. I mean, that's not particularly accurate in a scholarly sense, but I mean, but yet some kind of ethnic cleansing or genocide occurred somewhere in that mysterious historical gap, and something happened to the Britons, and you know, so the language became entirely Anglo-Saxon or, you know, later English. You know.
Well, then the French invaded and they confuse everything. The knight Gawain, who is a nephew to the dead King Arthur, refers to a battle of Badon. Was it really a battle of Badon?
Some people think so. I mean, it doesn't matter if the name of the place is accurate or not. A lot of people think there was one big battle that achieved some kind of peace. Now, that battle probably was won at atrocious cost. And that's what's, I guess, you know, I don't want to give away too much, but that's one of the buried giants of the story that people have forgotten. And they can only maintain this coexistence and peace with each other because they have forgotten the terrible atrocities that won them this peace. And I guess a lot of kind of states of peace we see around the world today are like that. Some peace has been won through consensus and negotiation. I think Europe after the Second World War is a genuine cause for celebration. But many other places in the world, there appears to be peace, but it's been enforced by some strong arm or dictatorship that's brought it down on people, and the resentments and the hatreds are preserved, almost like in ice, and they're going to explode once the tough guy at the top disappears. This is something we've seen repeatedly in the Middle East just in recent years.
Well, this process is obvious in your native land. You were born in Nagasaki in 1954, 9 years after the atomic bomb was dropped. Japan has been a relatively friendly trading partner with the United States in all the years since World War II, despite some horrific things. Your family moved to Britain when you were five, but the narrator in the book describes himself as being the descendant of an ancient procession that goes back to the 6th century. Do you feel very British?
Yeah.
Well, I realize this is fiction and your narrator isn't you.
Well, actually, just to pick up on that point about the narrator, what he's talking about there, I had this idea that this narrator was actually... Who was this narrator addressing? It's kind of mysterious for a lot of the book, and this wasn't a dimension I played up too much, but my idea was that gradually it would become apparent that the narrator was the you that the narrator addressed in the book. What was an audience of the slaughtered innocents, of slaughtered children throughout history? That's who the narrator is talking to. So that was my idea there. That ancient procession you just referred to is a reference to all the innocent kids and children who died in wars and in slaughter.
Some described your book Never Let Me Go as science fiction or more speculative fiction of the sort that Margaret Atwood has talked about. Where do you think of this as a genre novel?
When I was writing it, I didn't really think very much about genre. I never do. It's the same with Never Let Me Go. I didn't really think about whether it was science fiction or not. I usually get to some state in the writing of a novel where I'm actually really desperate. I can't get the story to work. I'm like a guy making a flying machine in the days before aeroplanes, and I just need it to fly. I don't care what it looks like. It might look really strange, but if it flies, that's okay, but I can't get it to fly. It's only when I finish that then, I can see how other people would look at it. And I think, maybe people think this is sci-fi, maybe people think this is fantasy. A lot of people are saying The Buried Giant is a work of fantasy. Fine, if they...
Well, you have dragons and ogres and all sorts of things that go beyond just the real world.
Well, the ogres and the pixies... they're part of the backdrop of this old ancient Britain I've created, and that was very important to me that they should be there. My rule of thumb there was that if a reasonable person of that time could actually hold a belief in supernatural forces, then I would allow it to literally exist in that fictional world that I'm writing. So, because I mean. Well, why wouldn't you? I mean, this is a pre-scientific civilization. I mean, if somebody dear to you has got seriously ill, you haven't got a scientific explanation. So why wouldn't you believe that a pixie had crept into the room at night, in the dead of night, and given your dear one an illness? I mean, that's as reasonable a belief as any. So in this book, I just allow that to be literally true.
In when I was reading the book, I thought of two contradictory but wonderful statements by other authors, L.P. Hartley, who opened The Go-Between with the line, "The past is a foreign country. They do things differently there." And then William Faulkner's famous line, "The past isn't dead, it isn't even past."
Well, that they're both wonderful statements, and I guess you know that those two statements do sum up, you know, the kind of same dilemma I was aiming at. You know, sometimes the past is something that you want to be dead, and sometimes you want it to be a different country, and sometimes it's not dead at all. And I guess you know the title of my book, "The Buried Giant." The buried giant refers to all those things within a marriage or in every nation. I mean, here I am in the United States. I've just arrived in the last hour in the United States. I would want to presume to ask, as a visitor, I would want to ask, what are the buried giants in the United States? But I'm sure you do have things that, a kind of an agreement that not to deal with some things, and maybe that agreement not to deal with some things is leading to some kind of unease, tension, some kind of open wound in society. I think almost every community, every nation, perhaps every marriage has buried giants.
Although I'd be happy to reveal all of our buried giants to you, but we've run out of time.
Yeah, well, maybe it's just as well you don't reveal all the buried giants.
Kazuo Ishiguro's latest novel is The Buried Giant. It's published by Knopf. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Thank you.
Don't wait another 10 years to come back.
Oh, it's great to be here again.
If someone in your family is a high school senior who's waiting to hear from the admissions department of Williams, Amherst, Princeton, Harvard, or any of the other elite U.S. colleges and universities, Frank Bruni's op-ed piece on surviving the college admissions process in Sunday's New York Times may have felt like a breath of fresh air. In it, Mr. Bruni looked at how and why the admissions process has become so intensely stressful in recent years and suggests ways for families to deal more effectively with it. The column was actually an excerpt from his latest book, "Where You Go Is Not Who You'll Be, An Antidote to the College Admission Mania." It's published by Grand Central. I'm very pleased it has brought Frank Bruni back to our show today. Hello.
Hey, hi. Thanks for having me.
Your column was the New York Times' most frequently emailed story all day yesterday, and this morning it's still at number two, and it's been shared more than 3,100 times on Facebook, received more than 4,200 likes. Have you been surprised by the amount of interest it's been getting?
Not really, and I'll tell you why, because I live with so many people, friends, relatives who have kids going through this process. And we have somehow managed in this country to turn the college application admissions process into the most frenzied, overheated, anxiety-rife rite of passage. And so I think people really, really are frustrated with it and looking for a path out of that anxiety.
And now you have a secondary career responding to the questions about the column and the admissions process on the Times Facebook page.
Well, we're all about reader engagement, and it was fun. I mean, it's nice to be able to talk directly to readers like that.
What are some of the most frequent concerns or questions that you've been getting?
I think people want to know how this all came to be. People are very confused because they remember it was always a heated process, even 20 years ago, 30 years ago when I went through it. I think people really are curious about how we got to this stage.
You've focused your book on the mania, and you use that word in your subtitle, around getting into the nation's most elite colleges. But aren't we talking about what's being experienced by just a small segment of the country's brightest and wealthiest college applicants?
We are, but I think that status consciousness filters down to all levels. I think that everyone ends up looking at where they go to school as if it's going to be some sort of harbinger of their future. And that's what's so destructive, and that's what we have to really push back at.
Well, the two things that I think they're most concerned about is when they're looking for a job, if it says Yale or Harvard on your resume, that's a lot better than if it says Manhattan Community College. And also, there's the networking aspect. Mm-hmm.
Well, I think those are short-term gains. I think over the course of your career, you're going to find very quickly that your college diploma, the relevance of that fades as your work experience takes on more and more importance.
And you actually cite a number of instances in this book. But you've called New York ground zero of the great race to get into elite colleges. Is the stress highest in the New York metropolitan area because of the wealth that is concentrated
here?
Yes,
it's partly about the wealth, and it's partly about the infrastructure of kindergartens and grade schools. Parents in New York are entering this competition to get their kids into the best schools, starting when those kids are about two, if not in utero. And so here it begins much earlier and goes on much longer.
But I would assume there's a lot of stress around college admissions on the West Coast, other parts of the country, for schools like Stanford, Berkeley, Duke, UVA.
Yes, especially in major metropolitan areas. But one thing we all forget on the coasts, and one thing we forget in general, is how helpful it can be if you're going to make your career in a given geographical area to go to, say, that state school. We're so focused on the schools with acceptance rates below 15% or 10%, or Stanford was 5% last year. We forget that for certain kinds of careers, and if you're going to live in certain areas, you're just as well served by going, say, to Auburn, by going to University of Texas if you're going to make your career there, by going to SMU if you're going to make your career in Dallas. There are hundreds and hundreds of schools out there that can be springboards to fantastic careers and fulfilled lives, and we only talk about a few dozen of them.
My guest is Frank Bruni, whose latest book is Where You Go Is Not Who You'll Be, an antidote to the college admissions mania, published by Grand Central Publishing. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. I mentioned Williams, Amherst, Princeton, Harvard earlier because they're at the top of U.S. News and World Report's most recent rankings of the best national colleges and universities. What criteria does U.S. News use to determine which schools are best?
Well, I tell you, one of the main criteria they use is what other college presidents, provosts, and admissions deans say, and what high school guidance counselors say. And none of those people have firsthand knowledge of, say, the quality of classroom instruction in any of those places. They don't really have firsthand knowledge of how those schools' graduates are doing. So they're going by reputation. The reputation is created by U.S. News and World Report. So it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. If you have a high ranking one year, you're going to have a high ranking in the years to come because people are going to be responding to that.
Are those schools the most difficult ones to get into?
Well, the most difficult one statistically last year was Stanford. It set a new benchmark with a 5% acceptance rate. I think you're going to see Harvard match or best that this year because it's already reported a record number of applications.
If they weren't the most difficult to get into before the rankings were published, they quickly became
really
difficult.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, we have the psychology. As soon as Stanford says, we only took 5% of our applicants last year, high school students around the country and their parents say, well, we've got to get into Stanford because that's the ultimate seal of approval. That is such a destructive psychology.
I'd imagine that U.S. News and World Reports has little incentive to change the way it ranks schools because they've been extremely popular and influential. Aren't they also a huge attention-getting and money-making enterprise?
Sure. Well, that's how U.S. News really doesn't exist as a magazine anymore. It exists as a ranking agency, and its Cadillac rankings, so to speak, are the college rankings.
But how much can we trust them? They also do hospital rankings, which are quite different from the ones that Consumer Reports winds up publishing.
Well, I mean, you have to ask this about all rankings. There's a famous saying, you measure what you can count. But what you measure doesn't really – I'm getting the saying all wrong. But you measure what you can, and there are all these things you can't measure. So they can look at the SAT scores, the median SATs of incoming students. They can look at class rank. They can look at that sort of thing. But you really can't capture what kids are learning. You really can't capture what's happening to kids 10 years out of college, 20 years out of college. There's no such thing as a best college. There is such a thing as mini colleges that will be very good for a given person, and that's the kind of discussion we need to have.
Didn't John Tierney, writing for The Atlantic's website in 2003, compare relying on the U.S. News rankings to eating Cheetos and drinking soda?
I think I quote that in the book, yeah, and I think that's a great – I quoted it in the book because I couldn't say it better myself.
Because people know it's not good for them, but they do it anyway. Why does the public continue to believe in that list despite – lots of knowledgeable people criticizing it and evidence that it's easily manipulated and based on factors that might be of dubious relevance?
Because it's always easier to outsource your judgment than to do your own research and investigation. And because people are insecure and they want somebody else to tell them how to live their lives.
On the other hand, you're not arguing that Williams, Amherst, Princeton, Harvard, Brown, Yale, Stanford are not great schools.
No, I think they're fantastic schools. I think one of the shames of the way things are right now is so many kids think once they get into one of those schools, because that's been the whole goal and the whole point of all their endeavors, that that's the end of the journey, that then they have it made. They're great schools if you insist on getting a great education at them.
Now, they've always been the schools that people wanted to get into. What's changed in recent years?
Well, the desire to get in has become ever more intense.
It's been ramped up.
The stratagems. I mean, you have a whole industry of independent college admissions consultants who charge $14,000 a weekend for an essay writing camp, who charge $50,000 to come on board when you're in the eighth grade and to coach you through every decision you make up until the 12th grade so that the admissions office at Harvard might smile on you. This is, I mean, there's a whole industry that didn't exist before and that I think is very corrosive.
And that doesn't guarantee that you get in anyway, because there are all sorts of other criteria for getting into these schools other than whether you can afford it and whether your grades are good.
Absolutely. There's no guarantee, and I'm really glad you mentioned that, because when you're talking about schools that have an acceptance rate of under 10% and a freshman class that's only so big, and then you factor in that a certain percentage of those admitted students are going to be star athletes, a certain percentage are going to be legacy cases, a certain percentage are going to be minorities for racial and ethnic diversity, there aren't all that many slots left. So if you're a kid tethering your self-worth and looking for validation in that acceptance, you're fighting a losing battle. Your odds are so slim that you're really setting yourself up for disappointment and heartbreak.
And I assume that the kids feel that if you apply to as many of these schools as you can, one of them is going to wind up taking.
You know, and as a matter of odds, that's probably remotely true. But because of that, we now have kids applying to 15, 18, 20 schools.
And it can be very expensive. And then there's the expense of the schools. How much of a factor is the cost of tuition in this mania? If parents expect to pay a college $60,000 a year for their child's education, isn't it hard to blame them for wanting the most that they can get out of their money?
No. I mean, of course they're going to be that much more discerning or simply paranoid about where their kids go to school. But, you know, what I'd like to inject into the conversation is how many schools out there are a decent deal and have great educations. No one ever talks about the amazing honors colleges that exist at many, many state universities. One I talk about quite a bit in the book, Arizona State University, has something called the Barrett Honors College. This is a phenomenal program that gives kids the kind of access to faculty and the kind of education that they could get at any small private college. And there it is at ASU, which is billed as a party school, you know, in the popular narrative, but in fact can be an environment in which you have a first-rate education. We need to acknowledge that sort of thing.
And then Arizona State is a remarkable school. They also have an incredible LD program for kids with learning disabilities where they help smart kids who have certain little miswirings in their brains get a college education at a top level.
And they have something else that I think is really important to mention about ASU and about a lot of state schools. They have a socioeconomic diversity that a lot of the Northeastern elite schools don't have. The Northeastern elite schools have a couple of students, a small percentage of the student body that comes from the lower income levels. You go to a state university and you get something that is much more like our society really is. And that, I think, is an important part of education.
Don't a relatively large percentage of Ivy League graduates study economics and finance and then work in banking and consulting?
Well, this has become a phenomenon of the last couple decades. Yeah, I mean, you have Ivy League schools that are sending a third to half of their graduates on to the management consulting and financial fields. And that's, think about that, that's really not a great thing for society.
Well, also those schools which have great arts programs. You spoke to some Ivy League graduates who said that they wanted they hadn't wanted to study finance. They felt out of step on campus.
Well, what happens when you have too many kids marching in lockstep toward the same destination, and this is, quite frankly, a danger of some of these Ivy League schools, is you have stories like the young woman you're referring to. She went to Columbia, she didn't know what she wanted to do, and she just sort of fell in with all of her peers, and she ended up in management consulting. She was miserably unhappy. She thought, I never paused because of the environment around me. I never paused to ask myself what I was really good at, what I wanted to do. She ultimately dropped out of management consulting. She's now in medical school at a non-fancy school on the West Coast. She's totally happy.
My guest is Frank Bruni. He's been an op-ed columnist for the New York Times since June 2011, has written frequently about higher education. His latest book, Where You Go Is Not Who You'll Be, an antidote to the college admissions mania. It's published by Grand Central Publishing, and we will continue our conversation after this. And we are back with Frank Bruni, whose latest book is Where You Go Is Not Who You'll Be, an antidote to the college admissions mania, published by Grand Central Publishing. I get the feeling parents hire the consultants you mentioned earlier partly out of fear that they will fail to properly prepare their child and fear that their child will somehow fail as a result.
You know, parents want what's best for their kids, and they want to give their kids a leg up. And we've been living in a period right now of enormous economic pessimism. And that's fueling this as well, because parents are feeling like if they don't do everything correctly, if they don't make sure their kids have every advantage, they might end up on the wrong side of the ledger. And so they're really just trying to do what's best. But if you're setting your kid up to pin all of his or her hopes on a school with an acceptance rate of 9% or 8% or 7%, are you really doing them a favor?
Yeah, you're setting them up for disappointment and perhaps even heartbreak.
Right, and they need to think about that, and they're not thinking enough about that right now.
What role have the social media played in heightening this mania?
Well, that's a great question, because now when I applied to schools and when I got my acceptances or whatever, I didn't have a way to broadcast them. I didn't have a temptation to broadcast them. These days, in the coming weeks, as these notices come in, if you go to kids' Facebook feeds, you'll see them saying, hey, I just got a yes from Harvard. Well, not that many of them will be able to say that. Or, hey, I just got a yes from Oberlin. It means everybody's sort of watching or able to watch what everybody else is doing. And so bragging rights have become more important to people.
And then you feel like you must have done something wrong if you're not doing as well as this student who you thought was you were just
right.
as smart as.
Everybody's out there watching, and the yardstick is right there on Facebook.
Your book advocates putting the college application process into better perspective and assures students and their families that they can still live happy and financially successful lives even if they don't attend an elite college. Didn't you speak with scores of business leaders, academics, and influential journalists who'd attended less prestigious schools and then prospered nonetheless?
Absolutely, yeah. The book is stippled with profiles of people who did spectacularly well in life and are very happy, which is even more important, and didn't go to vaunted schools. I talk at length to Howard Schultz in the book. He's the CEO, chairman, president of Starbucks. He went to Northern Michigan University. I talk to Dick Parsons in the book. He's the former chairman of Time Warner and Citigroup. He went to the University of Hawaii and actually fell shy a few credits of graduation.
Many years ago, I spoke with Carl Gerassi, who just recently died, the man who discovered the chemistry behind birth control pill. And he told the story of not being able to get into any decent schools because he was an immigrant. And it was recommended that he go to some lesser school that had a lot of new immigrant professors. And he said, you know, he was one of something like seven medical students with this incredible faculty that he probably wouldn't have had similar access to if he had gone to Yale or Harvard.
Person after person whom I interviewed in the book told me that they felt like they got to be, for lack of a better phrase, a big fish in a smaller pond. They felt like they could shine in front of faculty members at schools that weren't so overheated with competition.
And several people told you that they'd been able to take risks and try new things that they might not have tried at a school where the stakes are higher.
That's true. And another thing that's true is if you don't expect your diploma, the name of the institution on your diploma, to do all your talking and your work for you, you might hone a resourcefulness that you otherwise wouldn't, because you kind of feel like it's up to me and my efforts. No one's simply going to go weak in the knees when I mention my alma mater.
I think we should invite our listeners to join in for just a few minutes. We don't have a lot of time left, but if you want to write to us on our show page at WNYC.org, with something that might contribute to this conversation, or you can give us a call at 212-433-9692. That's 212-433-WNYC to talk with Frank Bruni, whose latest book is Where You Go Is Not Who You'll Be. I get a sense that your contention is that college should be disruptive by exposing the student to a new environment and providing a springboard for something new. But a lot of parents would be afraid of just that.
I think too many parents and kids look for a college that's merely an extension or an extrapolation of the secondary school experience. I think a much better way to use college, and I talk about this at length in the book, is as an environment in which you can upend what you already know, meet the kinds of people you haven't met before. College has that opportunity for you if you're privileged enough to be able to economically access it, and people don't use it that way, and that's a shame.
And some graduates of elite colleges told you that they'd been following a recipe for success for so long that they weren't sure what to do after they got out of college.
Well, that's true. Yeah, I mean, you ace all these metrics that are the things that college admissions committees are going to be impressed by. Then you get to the campus, and you're like, now what do I do?
Jill in New York wrote into our show page saying, I'm sorry, I disagree. It does matter greatly if you get into one of these top schools. I was a practicing attorney for over 20 years, and with maybe one or two exceptions, I never saw attorneys at top law firms unless they had been to a top school.
Well, I'm surprised to hear that, but also it needs to be said that certain professions are more partial to the Ivy League and its ilk than other professions, and that may be part of what's at work. But I disagree. I mean, I run into people all the time when I look around me at the New York Times, when I think of the scores, hundreds of successful people I've interviewed over my career as a journalist. I do not see a pattern that says that Ivy League and its ilk equal automatic success and have a monopoly on success. I just don't see it.
Peter from Manhattan. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Leonard, long-time listener, first-time caller, big fan of the show. I just wanted to call in to sort of more generally reflect that the emphasis that your guest is talking about on sort of how much these schools are seen not just to be a place where you go to learn, but an actual, like, a formation of an identity for the student. I graduated high school back in 2010, and when I was going through the process, I was also struggling with some, you know, moderate to severe mental health issues, including a real strong issue with self-esteem. And the process of applying to all of these colleges was so sort of intensified by this trend that the guest is talking about that in a lot of ways I completely withdrew from the application process. I went into a period of depression. I, you know, stopped doing my work in high school where I had been previously getting good grades because it seemed to me that, you know, the idea of getting into a college which might provide a good way forward or a solid future was nearly impossible, and then I just wasn't going to be able to live up to the standards of getting into.
So, Peter, what happened? What school did you wind up going to?
I actually ended up getting into Hunter College, CUNY in the city, and it was only because of a fluke with my SAT scores. They actually didn't admit me, but I went down to the office to ask them about it, and it turned out that the head of their whole admissions program was there. And after he saw the grades that I had gotten on my SATs, he looked through and talked with me. And he was able to change it from not admitted to admitted solely on the basis of the interview
and you
he
feel,
gave me.
And you feel you got a good education at Hunter?
Yeah. I mean, I definitely enjoy the education I get there now. But it's just such a different experience, actually, being in college than sort of the image you're given when you're trying to sign up of either go to Harvard or you haven't gone anywhere.
I want to say two things. Thank you very much for that call. You hit on something that really concerns me. We have taken a phase of life, college. If you are privileged and blessed enough to be able to economically afford or swing some way college, this should be the most exciting, happy phase of your life, and we've turned it into a sad juncture of anxiety and, as you said, sort of questioning your self-worth. Another thing, if I could do one thing with this book, I want to change the conversation from being about where can I get in to how am I going to use college. And what this book really does is try to give you some ideas of how to use and maximize college, because if you really focus on that experience, not the acquisition of college, but the experience of college and what you're going to learn and how you're going to grow, you are going to be well served regardless of where you went.
I'm not sure that anybody's ever checked to see if I actually went to the schools I said I went to. I mean, I haven't lied, but no. People have lied, and they've only been caught after they've become the CEO right. of some major corporation.
And they're not caught earlier because at the end of the day, you're judged by what you do in the workplace. You're judged by your efforts and your competence, not by the name on your diploma.
Lydia from Manhattan, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you, Leonard. I want to say that I think one thing that Mr. Green doesn't talk about is the role these colleges themselves are playing. I was pretty shocked when my son, who's a senior this year at a private school in New York, was able to apply early and was very fortunate to be accepted to his first choice. But after January 1st, he was contacted by Columbia University, which has a 7% acceptance rate, and encouraged to apply even after the deadline with what looked like a personal letter. Yeah. So my question is, why is a school that has a 7% admittance rate and has thousands upon thousands of applications still trolling for students to apply?
Well, that's...
There's something really wrong with that.
Well, maybe they thought he was good.
Well, they know that Stanford has a lower acceptance rate, and so they're chasing Stanford. I do talk a lot in the book about the role the colleges play in this. I wrote a whole column a while ago for the Times about the emails, the glossy pamphlets, the way in which colleges come on to students, often just to reject them.
Well, how do the colleges feel about the rankings? The ones at the top solicit more applications so that they can appear to be more exclusive?
They know because that it's a matter of human nature that if their acceptance rate says 5% or 6%, that makes them look more lustrous than an acceptance rate of 11%. So it's really, it's a horrible thing when you think about it. They are ginning up desire in order to frustrate it.
Maggie from New Jersey, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, I actually have been in the position of interviewing students for colleges. And one of the things, I'm from an area where everybody thinks the Ivy Leagues is the gold medal, and they don't understand that Ivy League education is quite a specific kind of education and that the Ivies are not all the same. So the idea of applying to all of the Ivies means you're stupid. But the other thing is that I tell the kids I talk to, look at the faculty, look at their resumes, look at their activities, look where they come from, and you will get a much better idea of what a department is like and where you might fit. And ironically, you know, a large portion of the really illustrious teachers came from very small little colleges for exactly the reasons that you discussed. They had a chance to grow, to blossom, to take risks, and they became better teachers, better thinkers.
Well, you mentioned small colleges. One of the things that really surprised me when I was researching the book was how many leading scientists started out at small liberal arts colleges that you wouldn't normally associate with the sciences. And the reason is the faculty attention they got. And even if the laboratory didn't have all the equipment that, say, they would have at UCLA, they had access to that equipment and weren't competing with graduate students for it.
A number of parents have pointed out that the same sort of competition applies to the elite private high schools.
Yes. Well, I mean, that's right. We were talking earlier about how it starts so early in kindergarten, then it goes to the elite private high schools, and it just continues and gets more intense at every phase as you go along.
Ray from the Lower East Side, hi. Can you make it quick?
Yeah, hi. I just want to talk about the scan that kind of employment numbers are in the field that you're going to study, that schools push. You know, they give you really high numbers, 90-something percent of graduates work in the field. And what they really don't tell you is that what that means is they've worked one day in the field since graduation. It's a total scam, and we got to break down the walls and disengage if we want to make a change.
That's not something I get into in the book, but it does sound like you have cause for concern there for sure.
One more call. Paul from Manhattan. Hi, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. I'm enjoying the show. I just wanted to say that I went to Columbia undergrad. I turned down a lot of smaller schools with some regret, so I intend to agree with the author. I think there's such an allure of the Ivy League that very often one feels compelled almost to choose an Ivy League school when it may not be in the person's best interest.
On the other hand, I've spoken to a number of people who teach at schools like Columbia after having taught at other schools, and they say that they prefer Columbia or whatever, because the quality of the students are often better. It's more enjoyable to teach those students.
I've heard that, but I've also heard not the opposite, but I've heard people say that they feel sometimes students at the most elite schools are a little bit too privileged and entitled, and they worry about that. So I think it really depends on the school, the group of students, the semester, all those things.
Do parents need to think differently about what they want for their children and what they expect from them?
Parents need to have a different kind of conversation. They need to separate this conversation from the luster of the school and the fanciness of it and how exclusive it is, and they need to talk more about learning and education. And they need not to let their kids tether their self-esteem to just those metrics that are judged by a college admissions committee.
You've concluded that a motivated student who's willing to work hard can get a top-notch education at almost any college, and
within reason, yeah.
But. Will you tell who are the ones who went to the school that nobody would want to go to who have really made it big?
There's a scientist who teaches at Stanford in the book who went to Calvin College, which is a small religious college. I mean, there's so many examples of the book of people who went to these small colleges. And also, one thing we haven't mentioned, people who bloomed late, you know, who weren't great in high school, so they didn't get into the most exclusive colleges, who weren't even standouts in college. People bloom at different stages of life, and we forget that truism when we put too much attention to the college admissions juncture.
Frank Bruni will be giving a talk and signing books tonight at 7 at Book College. That's at 450 Columbus Avenue. He'll also be speaking at the New York Public Library on 42nd Street tomorrow at noon. His book, Where You Go Is Not Who You'll Be, An Antidote to the College Admissions Mania, published by Grand Central Publishing. Also, I assume you'll continue responding to the parents who are writing into the New York Times?
I think those Facebook posts have ended, but I'm responding to parents by email and in all sorts of formats. I'm going to be speaking in some schools. I feel very, very passionately about this.
Thank you so much for being on our show again. It's been a pleasure having you here.
It's always a pleasure to talk to you.
Thanks for listening to Leonard Lopate Weekend. We'll be back live on the radio on Monday at noon, and be sure to follow us on Twitter at Leonard Lopate or at facebook.com/LeonardLopateWNYC. Enjoy the rest of your weekend.